everybody. I'm Christy Mathern.
And I'm John Lancey.
And you're listening to the Western Colorado Writers Podcast. Today we're here with the new poet laureate of the Western Slope, Wendy Vidalock. Wendy has published 6 books and has won many awards in her long career as a poet, including the PBTS Sonnet Prize, the Fisher Prize, and the Cantor Prize. And she's won the Keats Soul-Making Prize 4 times. Wendy has also been a 2-time finalist for the Rattle Prize and the Colorado Book Award. Her poems, reviews, and essays have been published in Poetry Magazine, O Magazine, Hudson Review, Best American Poetry, Hopkins Review, Rattle, The New York Times, Able Muse, American Life and Poetry, and other publications. Her newest book is a collection of essays called The Poetic Imaginarium, A Worthy Difficulty. So I understand you're hitting the ground running as the new poet laureate of the Western Slope. Can you tell us what you're up to lately?
Goodness. Well, thank you for having me, both of you. I really appreciate this. How fun is this? What am I up to? I am up to the same old stuff, just getting into trouble, trying to put poetry and the pleasure of poetry in as many venues and places as I can.
Oh, wow. Okay, so that sounds like getting the word out, which is one of your programs. That is where regional poets deliver invocations at formal events. Can you tell me which events?
Well, we've started with WSAT, which is Western Slope Against Trafficking. They do a monthly event. It's a pretty intense event, so having a poet there is a really appropriate thing to do. We're also doing not just invocations, which an invocation is a poem that sort of invokes and, you know, gets everybody sort of present and paying attention, but we're also doing land acknowledgments at a lot of events. So I've done land acknowledgments for house concerts, large house concerts in Palisade. We'll be doing these for Audubon. We're working with hospice to get poetry into their programs there. I would like to get squeezed into school board meetings. That would be a challenge. town hall meetings, things of that nature.
Okay, awesome. You had a program for the schools, right? The Good Morning Poetry?
Yeah.
I guess that's a morning poetry.
Yeah,
delivery.
So every morning administration sort of goes on the intercom at the schools K-12 and sort of says it's Monday, August 28th, mm-hmm. You know, and then they talk about what's going to happen that day or anything that anybody needs to know. So what I'm proposing is that a student or a faculty member read a poem during those morning announcements as a kind of a mindfulness practice, as also a kind of way of getting grounded, as also a way of just listening and not responding, because the program does not ask teachers to now discuss, dissect, or try to beat the meaning out of the poem, mm-hmm. Just to listen.
Oh, I like that. Mm-hmm. And you're already doing the Barefoot Laureate in the Grand Junction Sentinel.
Yeah, gotten some great response to that.
Cool, yeah. Cool. And Poetry on the Corner, which you're doing in Grand Junction. Are you doing something like that in Palisade?
Oh, you know, we're really trying. It's all about funding at this point. Oh. But we're hoping to start both places in 2024. So it's sort of an ekphrasis kind of project, which ekphrasis is a Greek old tradition whereby a poet writes about a piece of art, because way back then the masses did not have access to a piece of visual art, but the poet could write about it and then recite it, and those words could, you know, get out onto the internet, so to speak, back in ancient mm-hmm. times. So what we're going to try to do is to get a poet paired with 3 or 4 of the sculptors that work with these programs, so that during the unveiling the poet can recite the poem. Kind of gives the sculptor a starting point to talk about their work.
Interesting. Cool. Mm-hmm.
And your goal with these programs seems to be what you said before, which is just exposure to poetry.
You know, it's not just exposure, but also this idea that poetry is fundamentally fun and is a part of being human. It's our oldest art form, as far as we know. Of course, written, or spoken, or sung, which is where mm-hmm. the roots of poetry come from. And so many people think that they don't like poetry, but they're listening to it on the radio and enjoying it at ceremonies and wedding celebrations and graduations and inaugurations and funerals and memorials. It's something that's just embedded in our life experience. And the further we get away from it, the further we get from a sensitivity to language. Mm-hmm. And at the core of all of this is a respect and an honoring of the words that we use and how we use them.
I think it's I like the fact that you highlighted the fact that it's the oldest art form. For many years, I taught Greek, and poieo, from which poetry comes, means to do or make. And
it's a verb.
Yeah.
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 You had gone into what the Latin word for poetry means, or where it came from, carmen.
To sing.
Is, yeah, a song, a magic spell, a religious incantation. So I guess that is kind of like a verb. Are they similar?
I think, you know, in any case, in the ancient world, you're correct. Most people were not literate. And so they received by ear or sometimes visually. Like if there were words put up, they couldn't read them. But if there were pictures, they could, you know, that was how they learned, through pictures. Poetry was usually sung. I mean, think in terms of Homer, for instance. That was all sung. It was sung, and the rhyme and the rhythm was to help the person who's having to recite thousands of lines to remember them. And it was always something special.
Yeah, you know? And it's also really helpful to know that Rumi, who is our best-selling poet to this day.
Really? Interesting. One would have thought it was Mary Oliver, but anyway.
he didn't write little bite-sized things. Mm. He wrote in what's called ghazal form, which is an Arabic or a Persian form. Mm-hmm. And he was a whirling dervish.
He was a dervish, yeah.
So he never wrote anything down. All the poems that we have from Rumi are actually documented from those who were his sort of disciples and students. But I want to get back to this question of is it a verb or a noun, poetry? And is the Roman or the Greek? And the idea is that it's both and all. So that's the great thing about poetry, is it's not telling us to pick one or the other. It's saying and or. These things are not in contradiction, even if they seem that they are. So that we can say that, you know, poetry is a verb. It is to make. And so we often talk about lifestyle, that, you know, we have the poetic lifestyle, which simply means paying attention. It's really simple, paying attention. And then this notion, this very old-fashioned, rather less beloved notion of poetry as enchantment, as something spiritual, as something powerful, that is not really something that we can put our finger on, this Roman idea, really appeals to me. Because what it's really sort of touching on with the poetic sensibility is this idea that we don't know. We're not putting our finger in, smushing down an answer. What the poet is about is asking questions and about the journey. And so those asking of questions and the not knowing, it's the one thing that we don't know when we're going to die. We don't know what's going to happen with our kids. We don't know what's going to happen with our work after we're gone. So much of life is a mystery. And so poetry really is a practice in understanding the sort of magical, sort of mysterious aspects of life.
Mm-hmm. I think another way of saying what you're saying, too, or maybe adding onto it, is you could read a good poem over and over and over, and every time you read it, you see something you didn't see before, or you have an insight that you didn't have before.
That's exactly right.
It's very interesting because it's very similar to liturgical texts, for instance.
Yeah, yeah.
When I was a preaching man back in the day, and you would open the book for a liturgy of some sort, the Mass or something, it's written in poetic stanzas.
Psalms are all poems.
And the Psalms are all songs and poems. There's something about mystery and holiness, I think.
That's right.
You
That's
know?
Exactly right.
About
well,
poetry.
I would say I also came to poetry through, I was raised Catholic. Well, my mother was Catholic and my father was Lebanese. Mm. So I got a little bit of everything there. Mm-hmm, but that sacred notion that things that are written are supposed to have some kind of meaning, and also that the imagery and the way that you attach meaning to symbols is something that poetry does, too.
Yeah, you could argue even now. This talk about going off into the wilderness here. when Jesus spoke, the same sort of thing with Jesus as with, say, Homer or the ancient poets, these things were not written down by the actual writers. But as far as we can tell, Jesus spoke in parables. And the parables were oftentimes very poetic, although they weren't necessarily saved that way, but they functioned in a very similar way. You would hear a parable, and you wouldn't necessarily know what the answer to the parable is, any more than what you know, well, this is what the poem means, you know? And so there's something about the writing, I think good writing in general, even prose, gives us this door opening.
Yes.
A new way to see the world.
Absolutely. Well, and you, what you're touching on is the frightening thing about fundamentalism, where you can't
exactly
think in terms of parable, and you don't understand that these are written as metaphor, mm-hmm, and you begin to assign a meaning that this means that you cannot do this or you cannot approve of that.
Yeah.
And now we're going into a veering away from mm-hmm everything that is poetry.
Theologians talk about scripture as the living word.
Right.
And I've always thought of poetry the same way.
Right.
Because when I go back to it, I can't tell you how many times I've read some of Mary Oliver's poems, for instance. She's like my psalmist in the morning. And yet, you know, I've been reading her for 20 years, and I go to a poem that I can practically recite by heart, and I'll see something new.
Right.
Same with music.
When did you first start writing poetry? When did you first start thinking about all of this stuff?
I think I was drawn to poetry as a child. My mother would read nursery rhymes and poetry, and I remember William Butler Yeats really getting in, "Come away, O stolen child, to the waters and the wild, for the world's more full of weeping than you can understand." Talk about mystery and just being drawn to mm-hmm what that meant and how it was touching me without telling me exactly what it meant. I was a very quiet kid, and it really wasn't until my 20s that I began to learn that I'd been listening for long enough and that it was time to find my voice. It came from a trauma, and what I realized was that the people who are most affected by that trauma needed somebody to have the right words, and there didn't seem to be anybody there to do it. So I stepped up and decided it's got to be me. I could see this desire in these young kids. And so I was already teaching, and I already knew the power of language, but nothing about it was personal. And now it became more meaningful because there was a reason for me to discover what we call in the arts your voice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It takes most of us a lifetime. Or as Miles Davis said, you know, you have to work a long time to sound like yourself.
Yeah. Speaking of voice, I'm curious, has your voice changed since you were in your 20s? Mm. And can you say something about that?
Well, this is such a great question. I think in my 20s, I was probably more drawn to a Sylvia Plath kind of mentality.
Oh, dear.
I think I was more confused and angry,
mm-hmm,
maybe.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I realized that probably around in my 30s, actually probably around the time I had my kids, that I began to go on what can only be called the wisdom path. I started to realize that I was reading the poets who were more interested in finding some glimmer of hope and in finding something to learn from the more difficult aspects of life.
Mm-hmm.
The John Donnes, the Gerard Manley Hopkins, you know, a lot of them were actually, you know, come from the mysticism schools,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
the Rumis. Certainly Marianne Moore I would put in there too. Some of the haiku masters too. So that it was cultivating something else in me, so that I was beginning to learn that any kind of blame or all of that stuff didn't need to be fed. It was already there, and I wanted to feed some other aspect of human nature. Also, being a mom, I wanted to really be kind of walking the walk. You know, mm-hmm, if you want to teach your kids not to have fights with people, then you've got to kind of let go of whatever kind of resentment or blame or anger that you yourself are dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
And so poetry really helps us process this stuff because, mm-hmm, it's like Mark Twain said, how do I know what I'm feeling until I start writing it down? We really don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So it really is a mindfulness practice in
mm-hmm
the end.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Reading and writing.
Many times I've been to mindfulness retreats and workshops, and they always incorporate, okay, for the next half hour, be quiet and write a poem.
Yeah.
You don't have to conform to any sort of externals. You don't have to think you're a poet, because oftentimes people say, well, I can't write poetry.
And that's kind of what you're trying to break down, right?
Yeah.
Well, right. I mean, T.S. Eliot said you understand a poem long before you can comprehend, before you can understand, or I can't remember what
mm-hmm
order he says. But basically, it's the sound. And it's also, I think, intention really comes through, even
mm-hmm
though when we really look at a poem and want to look under the hood, there is a good reason for being able to talk about a poem. Not necessarily so that you yourself can appreciate a poem better, but to have the language to discuss a poem is a skill that poets really can cultivate. And because it allows us, number one, to be our own best critics, to know when something that we ourselves have written is ready for public consumption. Because one of the dangers is that people get turned off to poetry because there's so much of it and there's a lot of bad work out there. And so people say, oh, I don't like poetry. And that's like saying you don't like a film because you didn't like Dumb and Dumber. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it doesn't mean you don't like the movies. You didn't like that particular poem. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so what we do is we try to learn some crafting, you know, and craft is really at the heart of poetry. So there's really three levels in the writing of a poem that becomes a kind of a healing process. One is just sort of spilling out of whatever is coming. The second part is the most healing, believe it or not, and that is the crafting. Mm-hmm. People think that it's just the spilling that's creating some kind of healing or some kind of processing of the emotion. It's actually the crafting, because now what you're doing is you're creating order. You're creating beauty. You're creating song out of something difficult. I mean, this is the history of all the arts. And then, of course, the third aspect of that process would be sharing.
I like that sharing is part of the process.
Yeah. It's the other half of every poem is the reader. And also, I'll just add that we don't really read a poem. The poem reads us. So there are certain poems that are in the canon that people in certain camps of thinking will interpret one way, and in other camps of thinking might think an entirely different interpretation. A couple of great examples are Theodore Rethke's My Papa's Waltz. If you don't know it, look it up. And the other one is Robert Frost's The Road Not Taken.
Which, like, of course, everyone knows.
What they call the most misunderstood poem in America.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. Of course, now I want to ask, in spite of everything we just said, well, what does it mean?
Well,
I mean, which
I'll
is implied,
tell you what.
Which is implied in the statement that it's misunderstood. So
right.
If it's misunderstood, there must be a proper way to understand
it. Right. Well, I think this, that it's, again, it's not an and-or situation.
Good.
Because this is what I love about Frost in particular. Mm. Both interpretations are correct for you. So if you're interpreting that poem as somebody saying, if you take the untraveled road, everything will be better for you.
But that's
then that's what you need to get from that poem.
But that's not what it says.
But if you, that's not what it says.
Yeah.
But it is open to interpretation.
I see, of course.
Yes,
yeah.
And I love that you know that he's actually making fun of the human condition, because we look back and we say, as he says, I shall be telling this with a sigh. Mm-hmm. You know, years and years from now, I'll be saying it's because I took that road. But in the whole poem, he's saying these roads are exactly the same.
Mm.
And no matter what road I took, I would still be the same person. Now, the things on the outside might be different. I might be dressing differently or married to a different person. But me, I'll be the same.
Mm.
And
mm-hmm.
it's a much deeper metaphysical question that really looks at, are you a product of your circumstance? Or are you a product of how you perceive?
Mm-hmm.
Is it an inside job or is it an outside job?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a really deep philosophical question. And that's one of the beautiful things about Robert Frost, is that he's speaking to the farmer. He's speaking to the person who isn't necessarily college educated. And that person is getting an awful lot out of a poem. And then the academics and the scholars come along and they go, yeah, but look what he's also doing.
Mm-hmm.
He's also got about 12 other layers going on there.
Wow.
Yeah.
I am so tempted, although again, we're straying so far away, but I'm finding this really interesting.
Yeah.
What about the age-old question? I'm thinking of Robert Frost in particular, who was quite a curmudgeon, and that's to put it mildly. And that raises the question, can bad people create good art?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, boy.
2 days later, we ask the next question.
Yeah.
But it is an important question. I'm not saying answer it here, please. But,
I mean, I'll just touch on, it's a very difficult one. So as Yeats said, time forgives all the flaws of our geniuses. So, for instance, if a Tolstoy or a Robert Frost were alive today, they'd be canceled and nobody would
absolutely.
Be looking at their work.
Mm-hmm.
But because we have grown up with these masterpieces, and we now look back at them and we say this person was a wife beater, or he was a, you know, Frost was just brutal to people. He was unkind. But he was also conditioned. And so we look at a lot of these things, like all these guys were anti-Semites. All of them were racists. Our founding fathers all owned slaves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we come to terms with it because you don't necessarily have to be a saint in order to have saintly ideas. It's complex. If they're alive today, I wouldn't be reading a Robert Frost because the consciousness is different. Mm-hmm. He would know better in this day and age. He would
I'm
have
not
a
sure
different...
he would, but one would.
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. Because poets are really usually sort of tapped into the collective consciousness.
Mm. Don't get me
but,
going
but
on
I
that.
But I could be wrong. I could yeah. be wrong. Mm-hmm. But it's a really, really complicated question, and it's not just Frost. All the geniuses, all of them, have come to light. They were very, very flawed. It's only a new notion, particularly since the women have entered the arts, that we don't have to choose the art or the life. Mm-hmm. You can have an artful life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you can still make well-crafted, beautiful, powerful art and still not be a monster at home to your spouse and your mm-hmm. kids. This is a very new idea.
Yeah, yeah, unfortunately. But
yeah.
Oh, I'm so glad I was born in this age.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. To go back to process, how has yours evolved over time and what did it look like early in your career?
Well, I think process for me has always come from sound. I'm really, really drawn to musical aspects, and I never really knew anything about prosody or meter or any of that stuff until colleagues said, you're writing in iambic pentameter, and you're writing tetrameters, and you're really good with demeters, and I didn't know, what are you talking about? Because I had read, and I was picking up on a lot of these rhythms, and the interesting thing about what we call fixed form is that they're not really fixed. What they are, it's sort of like musical scores. Like, there's only so many chords. There's only so much that you can do. But it's the way that you put them together. It's just like anything else, like a painting. There's only so many colors. But it's the way that we put these things together. So the real trick with working with things like rhyme and meter is that people think that it's a template, and you kind of put it over mm-hmm. a piece of work, and you have your rhyme in certain places.
A, B, B, A.
Yeah, and really,
C, B,
yes.
C.
Yeah, and mm-hmm. so people think that it's a bad rhyme if you've rhymed, you know, June and moon and spoon, when actually what it is it's your syntax. So if you're landing your rhyme, this actually comes from A.E. Stallings, if you're landing your rhyme on a noun every time or on a verb every time, it's going to sound really clunky. Mm-hmm. If you're landing it on really uninteresting syntax, language, and grammatical structure, it's going to sound like really bad Hallmark verse. Mm-hmm. If you're playing with that idea and keeping a general sort of meter, then when you change the meter, it suddenly becomes powerful emotionally because the expectation has been thwarted. So what we do in sort of the formalist world is you kind of create an expectation, and then at a very important emotional point in the poem is when you thwart it.
Mm-hmm.
So that now you're alerting your reader, so that the layperson will read it and be very moved but not know why. But the person who knows a little bit about crafting will go, oh, look at how they mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. made a substitution there and changed the emphasis of that. You know, the feminine endings and masculine endings have a very different effect on the emotional response that we have.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that's like part of the magic.
It is part of the magic.
Little...
Yeah, there are tricks up the sleeve of the poet. There's no question about it. We do manipulate language. We are rhetoricians. And then there's also that aspect of just not knowing what's going to happen. The best poems I've written, I have no idea really where they came from. But I know that I was preparing all of my life by reading poetry and writing it for that to happen without me knowing how it was happening. So you have to kind of put yourself in a position where you can receive.
Do you have to cultivate your unconscious?
I think what happens is that when a phrase or a sound comes to me,
mm-hmm.
then I start walking around with it for a few hours or a couple of days. One of the first poems I wrote that really felt like my own voice went just north of mist beyond the border. And I just kept going just north of mist beyond the border, just north of mist beyond the border. And it had this mysterious quality, and it sounded like a kind of a directions, like you're giving somebody directions. And I just kind of went with it, and it just kept going and going until all of a sudden it finished. It wasn't like I had to craft it or put it together. And so having that happen, now you're always trying to get to that place again where you start with something and then the poem meets you and says, okay, here's where we're going.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's what they used to call the muse. Inspiration, that very word inspiration mm-hmm. comes from religious thought, metaphysical thought, mm-hmm. you know, the divine breath.
Mm-hmm.
Or to go back to Frost, not I, but the breath that flows through me. He was very aware of the fact that he wasn't that guy in the poems. people always often say to me, "Oh, you're so wise." It's
no.
The wisdom comes,
but it's
It's just like everybody else. I have a moment, and then I'm right back to all of my fallbacks and all my conditioning.
So your process has always involved music and sound.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Has that deepened or changed at all in your...
No, because if I try to check something off, like, oh, I really need to have a villanelle or really need to have a sestina in my repertoire. No, I'm going to have an exercise poem. It taught me the rules. I've got it. Now I'll be ready if something comes to me and wants to be in that form. But mostly, the reason that we force ourselves into a form is to be ready for when the real one comes. So you can write, you know, 500 sonnets, and then you get the 501st one is a real sonnet that just comes through you and couldn't have come in that form if you hadn't trained yourself.
So being an artist, on the one hand, you have to have a pretty good ego to put yourself in a position where you think that somehow the muse, if you will, could somehow work through you.
Right.
But on the other hand, you've got to get rid of the ego.
Right.
Because the ego is the one that says A, B, B, A, you know, and...
All power to the paradox, baby. That is it right there. Mm-hmm. There's this thing called imposter syndrome. So the poet has the imposter syndrome no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care who you are. You will still always feel that you just really don't know what you're doing.
How did you get here, and how is it that what you created is being responded to so well?
Right. When I'm writing a poem, I know when my ego starts coming in too strong because the poem starts getting really clever. I can have aspects of that, but if it's the primary, the dominant force or impulse, I know it right away. And and usually what happens is that I have to put that piece aside. And then there might be something to salvage from it later on, but I need to detach from it.
That must have been something you grew into.
I think it did take me some time because... There were, when I first started publishing, and people always think they're supposed to start publishing early on, and I say, no, you'll regret it, because Rilke or Keats, these were rare people who wrote beautiful works in their early 20s and even in their teens, I think.
Mm-hmm.
That's very, very, very unusual. It just doesn't, you haven't gotten the life experience. But what happens is that, you made one good poem, you start to think you know what you're doing, and then you start going down that little
path.
The ego. Yeah, that's that ego coming in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The poem always knows.
Talking about how your work has changed over the years, you've been attached to rhythm and music, and I'm guessing that's where the rhyming comes from, is this playfulness with meter and rhyme. A lot of people's first exposure to poetry is with rhyming poetry, like the classics. When they're teaching form to you, it's always, almost always, with rhyme.
Mm-hmm.
But I went to school for creative writing, and I took several poetry classes, and rhyming was never encouraged.
No, no.
It was like, it was almost, they were saying, here are the classics, they all rhyme, but it's outdated. Like, what is that?
That's such a great question. Okay, so you're right. Kids love rhyme, and they love good rhyme. That nursery rhyme really plays with it, and really, there's just such great stuff out there, the classics. I mean, and even to this day, Silverstein and Prolutsky, these guys are good at what they do. And it's a great sort of gateway to poetry. But what happened is that along came Whitman and Ginsberg, and these guys wrote amazing free verse and what we call blank verse. Now, blank verse is not free verse. A lot of people don't realize this. Blank verse is just iambic pentameter that isn't rhymed. But these guys had studied their meters, and then they wanted to abandon it and create this whole new rhythm, which they did, kind of like Hopkins. They created their own. The reason they were able to do it is because they'd learned their chord. It's like playing piano. I watched my two kids play it from two very different approaches and saw that you really can't create unless you know something. E.E. Cummings could do brilliant things because he knew the rules of grammar. So Whitman we needed, because we needed to get out of that Victorian idea of that everything was purple and flowery and beautiful and poorly rhymed in the Victorian age. And so the poets came along and went, this is just, you know, not speaking to the human condition now. We've dealt with Hitler. Like, this is an awakening. Like, you can't just do these pastoral poems anymore. We've got to be real here. And so Whitman and Ginsberg were really, you know, front runners with this. And then you had Emily Dickinson, who's writing in church form, like the Psalms and the hymns mm-hmm. and stuff like that. But she's questioning fundamentalism mm-hmm. within it, so that within that form she's questioning, whereas Whitman was questioning it outside of that form. So you had all this sort of structure like moving outside of that, and we needed it. So what happened is, like everything, the pendulum swung so far away that now poetry began to look just like prose. And that's when the masses went, we don't really like this. It doesn't really sing. We'd rather turn the radio on.
Mm-hmm.
So new formalism said, well, here's the thing. Beauty is still something that people want to hear about in poetry, but it can't be the only thing. We have to be real. We've got to really be touching on everything, that what it means to be human. And so they kind of saw that in the schools, nobody was learning anything about meter. They were basically writing prose and cutting it into lines. And they said, look, here's the thing. We're going to make two journals. They made the New Formalism and one other. And that was the only outlets. Everywhere else were free verse. Everywhere you looked were the big yeah. ones. And then along came Chris Wyman. I don't know which one of you came up
that
with those
me.
Questions. You talk about the metaphysical and all of that. He's a good one for you to read right now in your life,
that's why
too.
I'm doing it.
and he may be, quote, Christian, but he's a questioning Christian, mm-hmm. and he comes at it as a poet. He's kind of like a C.S. Lewis, that he had to come back to it later in life, mm-hmm. and through a questioning eye. Like, you don't just blindly look at these doctrines. Like, how did they come about? So he was really in a position to not go, everything's going to be formal, and not go, everything's going to be free, but to go, if I find a good poem that's formal, I'm going to print it. And if I find a good poem that's in free verse, I'm going to publish that too. And guess what? I'm going to put them in the same journal. That was just
smart. You
know, smart. Of course, now it's a little different. But back, you know, this was 25 years ago, when new formalism was still trying to get its foot in the door and trying to get back into the schools and say, look, at least have a class in meter. Like, at least teach how it's done, so that when people do try it, they're not doing Hallmark. And also, it's not just about rhyme. Like, a lot of these forms do not have to be in rhyme. They don't have to be end rhymed. You know, it's not like that.
Your work plays with a lot of middle rhyme. And
I mean, it's all about the surprise for me.
That, I think, is what makes it so good.
Thank you.
It's playful and jumpy and changes. It breaks the form.
And it finds meaning on its own. So I'm not trying to find meaning and make some big meaningful statement. The language itself contains the meaning. That's the powerful thing about poetry, is that it just somehow shows us.
Poetry incorporates the senses in a way that other forms of writing usually don't, something I've always respected about it. You can look at the structure of a poem on the page, and it turns into visual art sometimes. Like, you can play with the shape of the poem, and it can be made of experiences, sensory experiences, in a distilled form versus a novel or something where it takes a while to soak in. So it doesn't surprise me that you do visual art as well. Can you talk about how practicing multiple art forms can sharpen them all, or what it does for you?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. So let me just say something about how poetry is on the page and how you can kind of play with it. So at its core, the difference between poetry and prose is really simple. Prose goes to the end of the line. Poetry is a different animal. And Billy Collins, who, by the way, is one of my favorite people to talk about poetry, when he talks about poetry, mm-hmm. he's very, very funny and also very insightful. Mm-hmm. And what he says is that the poem at the end of every line is inviting you to go back in at the end of every line.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just that Shakespearean notion of that you take a breath there. And mm-hmm. it's true that you do. That's what iambic pentameter came out of, is from mm-hmm. being on stage, delivering these
needing
lines.
Needing to breathe.
And needing to breathe. It's a really practical notion, right? But this is a kind of a metaphysical way of looking at, you know, the line break, is that it's inviting you to slow down and to look within.
Mm-hmm.
That's a Billy Collins-ism. Joni Mitchell says, she calls it crop rotation. You have to know a little thing about farming and a little bit about the arts to get that metaphor. You have to let the soil rebuild and get its nutrients. And if I'm working too much with words, then sometimes I just am tired of the sound of my own voice. And sometimes that means my actual voice, and sometimes it means on the page, but I just need to silence. And so the visual art is just a really good crop rotation. I'm very playful in my writing, but I also take it much more seriously than I do the visual art. So there's a different relationship that I have with it, even though the visual art is more lucrative.
I love vibrant colors. I'm just drawn to them. But one thing that bothers me sometimes about vibrant colors is that the artist seems to be just putting the color there to sort of catch my eye, not to tell me anything. When I look at your paintings, they do so much more than that. Mm. The question I wanted to ask you was, do you see a connection between your poetry and your art? I see a connection. And the connection I see is, in both cases, you're inviting me in not to just look at something like an illustration, but to go deeper, go inside it. You can go inside good painting just like you can go inside a good poem.
Yeah, I think color is kind of like rhyme and meter in that it can be just thrown over the top and doesn't look like it belongs there. Or it can be integral to the piece. And they say that the meaning of a poem is its form. And it's true of a painting, too, that the meaning is in its form. Like, yeah, you can deconstruct it, but that is the meaning. It's the way that it's written. That is its meaning. And so that's why we say you can't really deconstruct a piece of art satisfactorily, because it will always leave you wanting, because the piece of art is the meaning.
Well, and it is the meaning, but it's not self-evident without a little bit of the viewer putting himself or herself into it.
We're co-creating.
My favorite word, I actually put it in the book title, you know, to co-create. We co-create our world.
Yes, we do.
We do it together. Of course, in my field, in theology, we do it with God. But one way or the other, we're not in this alone. And if we are alone, whatever we create doesn't really come alive until someone else sees it.
Well,
even if they don't like it.
I love this. I mean, I think it was Einstein who said, you know, reality is a lie, albeit one that we have agreed upon. So there is this collective creation, right? And it creates a certain kind of plane. And then there's all this kind of wiggle room. I mean, yeah. I really do believe that poetry and theology are sisters, and really close sisters, and that it breaks my heart when there's kind of a, you know, a fundamental understanding of religion and theology.
Well, you're preaching to the choir here.
I used to
say to my freshmen, now you are aware that not only all art originated in religion, but even sports originated in religion. You know, if we went back to the Olympics in the period of Greece, we would think we were at a religious ceremony. Everything was done for the gods. And then, you know, that even crosses culture. I know a lot less about it, but in Central America, we look at, I think it's the Aztecs, the Incas, with their ball playing. They have ball courts. We're trying to figure out what they are. Well, they probably were some sort of ritual, or at least they were done like the Olympics to honor the gods. Religion and art, just as I would say religion and science, they're not at odds.
How do I not know you?
Oh, I'm so happy. You'll do need to make friends.
Yeah, for sure.
We should teach a course together.
I would love that.
Let me ask a question out of left field, which probably no one can answer. Is there a difference, do you think, generally between men's poetry and women's poetry?
Well, as Mark Nepo says, none of us have any of the answers. We're all just comparing notes, which is a really great way to discuss things because, you know, this is another thing I love about the arts. I always say there was nowhere for me to turn but the arts because I didn't want to land on an answer. I wanted to land on a place that allowed me to swim around in these notions. Gender is fluid. This is what we're learning from these young people.
Absolutely.
And so poetry is known as a kind of a feminine practice because it's so receptive. It's about receiving. People think it's about putting stuff out there. It's really about receiving in order to put it out there. So that there's something about it. But you also have to have the masculino in there in order to be able to speak it and get up and write books and do all of mm-hmm. this. So it's this perfect mix of these things. And mm-hmm. remarkably, many of the poets that I know are scientists. They mm-hmm. come from the world of science and tech and lawyers. I know a lot of lawyers who mm-hmm. are poets and historians and electricians and, you know.
Macho Men? What about someone like... This is coming out of left field here. Yeah. Bukowski, have you mm-hmm. read him?
Mm-hmm.
I read him years ago, so yeah. I can't quote, but my yeah. impression was that he was, on the one hand, I really liked his poetry. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, it was hard to really jump into it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking now, although that probably isn't fair to him or his shade, that there you have a real macho guy.
Mm-hmm.
Henry Rollins is another one whose poetry I have not read, but who they come across as these macho men.
Right.
And oftentimes go off into doing other things, mm-hmm. usually drinking.
I would say this. Let's just stick with Bukowski because he's such a iconic kind of bad boy, mm-hmm. toxic masculinity,
mm-hmm.
really.
Mm-hmm.
Tender as can be.
That's what I was just
saying. So, you know, yeah. I mean, that's the great dichotomy there mm-hmm. is that this was a guy who was just, you know, cruel and bitter and, you know, to women, treated them poorly. And yet, if you really look at the poems, some of them are just so tender that it's heartbreaking. So it's sort of like the curmudgeon who, you know, if you scratch the surface, they're just a big softy, but they don't want anybody to know that they're a big softy.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of women like this, too. Let's not, you know, there are a lot of women, particularly old school, you know, where you don't show your feelings kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
where they have to sound like they're making fun of everything and, you know, pull your bootstraps up kind of people, and then you scratch the surface and they're just softies.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it has created bully culture because the bully is, they like that. It makes them feel important. And also, the bully culture needs others to be looking on and going, yeah, do that.
Which they typically probably, well, I shouldn't say what I don't know, but my suspicion is it would be really hard to say yeah to that unless you are not really reading the poems.
Right.
You just read the persona.
Right. That's exactly
you
right.
know, the ego mm-hmm. again.
Interesting question.
Yeah.
I don't know where these questions come from.
I like that we've gone off script and come back to it. And
I do want to ask you, though, Christian Wyman, the editor of Poetry Magazine, seems to be a fan of yours. He's published a lot of your stuff. And I've been reading his memoirs in which he is struggling with terminal illness. But he's also struggling with the muse, if you will. It got me to thinking. Some people, I think, argue that you can't write well without having had adversity in your life. And I'm wondering, what do you think of that?
I just have to tell a little anecdote about Chris Wyman.
Oh, cool.
Because you mentioned Mary Oliver.
Mm-hmm.
He tells a story about how he was given a book of poems by Mary Oliver to review.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, oh, God, I couldn't review this. I'll pan it.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he just had to pass it up. And then he was invited to do a gig with her somewhere in Chicago or something.
Mm-hmm.
And he meets her at some bus station or something, and they're hurrying to this event and crossing a busy street. And as they're crossing the street, there's a dead bird in the middle of the road. And he says, Mary Oliver, in Mary Oliver fashion, bends down to pick it up and begins examining this dead bird and pointing out that this is where it must have gotten hit by the hawk. This is the hawk didn't get to eat it because something must have happened. The hawk had to drop it. She's creating a whole story about this bird. And then she puts it into her pocket. And then they go and they do this reading at the Chicago, that big poetry center, that the poetry center has billions of dollars.
Yeah.
They were given all kinds of money. And so they do this whole reading and they go out to eat afterwards with all these emissaries of poetry. And as they're walking out of the event, she reaches into her pocket and pulls the bird out again and begins examining the bird again. In other words, she's there to do what she has to do as this famous poet, but she's more fascinated by this bird. And that is Mary Oliver. And as he said, in that moment, he had so much respect for her and for the following that she has, and that suddenly he began to understand that mm-hmm. this was not a posturing, that she really is that person,
mm-hmm.
that she's not putting this on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Love that story.
And she went through a great deal of adversity in her life.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, yeah. The older I get, the more I think that we all have adversity. And that sometimes it might look like it's more dramatic in certain situations, but that we all have different sensitivities, and that we all have this thing called difficulty, trauma, abuse. Mm-hmm. We've all experienced this. It may look worse and better. Let me tell you, the people that look like they had it the best in life, you often scratch those surfaces, you'll find a different story. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And often those who say that they've had it the worst don't seem to have really when you scratch that surface. So it seems to be like there's this thing that happens where there's this even playing field, so that maybe a person who's extremely sensitive only needed a little bit of adversity for it to have the same effect as somebody who lived in a war zone in their childhood. So that it seems to me that everybody has had adversity, and that therefore anybody could write successful poems. Not everybody wants to. Mm-hmm. That's really seems to be the difference. I would say that the poet has, my friend Jack Mueller used to say, a profound sensitivity to language. But again, as the years go by, I think everybody has a profound sensitivity to language. They're just not acting upon it in a way, but they're still getting really their feelings hurt when someone uses words they don't like, whether they're coming from the right or the left. And they have a really strong reaction to certain words. So we all have this extreme sensitivity to language, which mm-hmm. which is why language to me is so fascinating. It's just got so much power over us.
You just mentioned not everybody writes poetry because they maybe don't want to. What would your advice be to a young person, I'm talking maybe 20s, mm-hmm. who really does want to write poetry?
Don't.
No fair.
I mean, I would say that the same thing that I say to any student: read. Ah. Pay attention mm-hmm. and read. This is how we learn how to write, is by reading. I had a teacher once who used to say, never trust a writer who writes more than they read. Mm-hmm. It's very obvious when you read the work of someone who doesn't read. They think that they're striking new ground when it's something that's been done 1,000 times. If you're writing science fiction and you're writing something that looks just like Lord of the Rings, and you don't know that Lord of the Rings exists, you really ought to know that it exists, and you ought to learn from it, and sure. then go off and find your mm-hmm. own kind of niche in that world. And it's the same thing with poetry, that the more we read of it, the more that we're able to find a voice that's really kind of unique. Mm-hmm. If you only read a little bit, then you're going to be writing really derivative stuff because that's all you know. So mm-hmm. if all you read was Poe or Bukowski, this is one of the reasons that Bukowski has such a bad reputation. Not because of who he was, but because of the school that he founded after him. Mm-hmm. Because people were trying to be just like him, like sure. tough guy, and didn't
and
have
the
same facility.
And I'm not
going to
write a thing until I'm drunk.
And I can't write until I'm wasted.
Yeah. I'm wondering what aspect, if you were talking to a person who was wanting to write poetry or was struggling with it, definitely the number one thing would be to read. Mm-hmm. As somebody who read for 40 years, read students' papers, you could tell the readers from the not readers
yeah.
because of the way that they were so familiar with language.
Right.
And when they would write, there would be a natural rhythm to some
yes.
of them, you know? And
yeah.
It would be just beautiful.
Just genuine.
What about the need for mindfulness? I would say to somebody, read, but also pay attention
yeah.
to yourself
yeah.
as well as to the world.
Right.
I mean, again, yeah. going back to Mary Oliver, again and again, pay yeah. attention, pay attention, pay attention.
Yeah, I mean, I can't tell you how disappointing it is to me when I'm communicating with people who aren't paying attention. I just think that they're really giving themselves like a really rough life. Like just paying attention, not just to your own thoughts, but to what people are saying, to the wildlife around you, to the
traffic. What people are feeling as well.
What people are feeling. I think that we all start out as empaths. And the thing about the empath is that they're not just imagining what it's like to be the river, the pine tree, the homeless person. Mm-hmm. They're feeling it. They're not faking it. So there's a difference between empathy and sympathy and compassion. They're mm-hmm. very different. And mm-hmm. empathy, it takes a long time to realize that when you're feeling someone else's feelings, it's very, very painful. Mm-hmm. Which is why people avoid it.
Exactly.
So I get it. I get it. Mm-hmm. I think that the poet comes to poetry because they're already an empath. they're already being moved by something that they've heard or read or come across. So we always start with this notion that we want to relive that. We want to understand where that came from. Usually it's childhood. Something happens, we're being read to or reading, and some magical thing happens. And so we spend the rest of our lives chasing it because it's the most amazing feeling ever. Mm-hmm. Some people have a feeling of, you know, divinity. And that was the case with me, is that I never felt that in church, but I felt that in nature. Mm-hmm. And so that feeling, we want to cultivate it. We want to create it. And then as we get older, we want to create it for others. We want to make it available.
It's an invitation.
It's an invitation. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can an extrovert write poetry?
Mm.
Most of the people that I know who write poetry are introverts.
Interesting.
And again, I'm not being too clinical on this, but I think from a Jungian perspective, the extrovert finds reality out there and
right.
jumps into reality and is energized by reality out there.
Yes.
The introvert finds reality within
mm-hmm.
and is energized when she's alone or
right.
you know, with one or two other quiet people.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think of an extrovert, an extroverted poet.
I can think of a few that come across as
very. I'm sure when you were teaching, you were like me. I came across as an extrovert. People to this day assume
people don't get it. They
no.
go, "What? You're an introvert? You seem such a
they
natural."
They think I'm crazy. So maybe it's not a matter of introversion and extroversion as much as an ability, because extroverts aren't just extroverts.
That's right.
I think maybe an ability to look within, to discover from within.
So I'm going to answer like I do with all the others, and that is find all kinds of ways in between.
Mm-hmm.
You know the Barbra Streisand song, people who need people. I never got that as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
As I always thought, oh, I've got my books. I was sort of like,
I am a rock.
I am a rock.
Island.
I
Simon
am an
Garfunkel.
Island, Paul Simon. So what I came to know was this, because I had two kids and they both seemed such opposites. And they both defied their gender roles. And they both defied their social roles in so many ways that it changed everything about the way that, and I'd even been teaching for many years and observing gender and all these kinds of things. And I just have come to realize that everything is contextual.
Mm-hmm.
Everything.
Mm-hmm.
So when we tell ourselves that we're introverts, which we know that's based on the fact that if we could be at home with our books and our dog or cat or whatever, that we would prefer it.
Mm-hmm.
But that if we couldn't go out to that occasional event, we'd be suicidal.
Oh. Yeah.
And so what happens is that we start to realize, because I noticed this during COVID, I was sort of like, oh, this is a great opportunity for me to not have to make excuses to be here and there and everywhere. And after about a year, now most people it took about 3 weeks, but after about a year, I got really antsy and I realized that I was more social than I realized.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That kind of box that I had put myself in about introversion, I began to see that that, too, is it one of those putting you into a polarity
yeah.
thing. When
yeah,
we,
yeah.
we really have everything is contextual and we change. So that some of the poets who seemed so out there, like a Dylan Thomas or an Edna St. Vincent Millay, they seem to get all their energy, because this is really how we describe intro and extroversion, is are you getting your energy from being around people? But I can tell you right now, I'll walk out of here energized, but also exhausted.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And both of those things can exist.
Yeah.
Whereas
yeah.
we think it's one or the other. And so what do they say about poetry is kind of like where mixed emotions are allowed to exist together. So you're allowed to be both exhausted and exhilarated, and you're allowed to be, you know, introverted and extroverted. It's kind of like Whitman said, I contain multitudes.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to kind of integrate everything. Because even like when I go on and on about dualities and fundamentalists, I know that I must have aspects of those things that I'm still working with, or they wouldn't be part of what I'm working with all the time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And what I'm kind of exploring in my work and in conversation and in classes and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I'm teaching it is because I need to learn it.
Mm-hmm.
So I picked up your book, The Poetic Imaginarium, A Worthy Difficulty, this week. And among all the other stuff that struck me, I really liked the title chapter a whole lot. In it, you define kitsch as one of a writer's pitfalls.
Yeah.
And you quote Milan Kundera, who defines kitsch as the absolute denial of shit.
Mm.
Can you talk about what that means in the context of poetry and how it gets in the way of poetry's purpose, which is to enchant, as it later says in this chapter. And maybe what is an example of kitschy poetry?
Well, if you asked me 10 years ago, I would have said Mary Oliver, and I'm not kidding.
I believe it.
Yeah. Kitsch, there's no other way to say it. It is the absolute denial of shit. It's as though you're in this purity realm, which I now know Mary Oliver is not in. It's this kind of realm where everything is a Hummel tchotchke, and nobody wants to talk about the physical body and what happens to it, and nobody wants to talk about the shadow, the Jungian.
And you mentioned Duende, too.
Yeah, so Duende is kind of like this notion of the memento mori, where, you know, you have this beautiful painting by the old masters, and it's got beautiful watermelon and apples and all these abundance, and then in the corner is a rotting skull. So this would be a kitsch if it weren't for that, which is acknowledging that your time here, you know, and that, you know, there's this corruption thing. And it's not just of the physical body. There's also corruption of the spirit. And the rotting of, you know, systems, all of that, putting it all in there together kind of allows us to not just concentrate on the anger of the youth kind of element, and also just not concentrating on that Victorian thing where everything is purple prosy and everything is beautiful and everybody's being compared to a red, red rose.
In the first page of that chapter, you mention where you ask your students what the most important relationship you will ever have in this life is with blank. Would you say it is shit? That's what I was opening the book for.
That's a great question. So this is actually a Jungian question. Well, it wasn't a Jungian question. It came from a Jungian statement whereby I realized that this was true of myself and probably true of everybody else. And that was that the most important relationship that I have in this realm is with my own demons. If I'm, you know, having an argument with my husband, really the argument is with me. That's what that recognizes, is that there's something about him that's reminding me of something that I need to resolve. The poetry is such a great way to sort of work with those inner elements.
My final question.
All right.
It's about finality. Mm-hmm. Have you ever written about death?
Oh, my goodness. Every poem is about death.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Can you say a little more?
Death and
about
sex.
That?
I mean, poets are death obsessed. Mm-hmm. We're practicing.
Practicing for your own
transition.
Death.
Yeah, mm-hmm. For that.
The transition.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I think a poem is a stay against death. A kind of a momentary stay, as Robert Frost would say, against confusion, against fear.
Isn't that what art is?
Yeah, I really do think. We have a culture that's kind of death denial. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't like to talk about it. We don't like to think about it. Poets are here to remind us on the daily. Even a praise poem is all very much aware that the reason that we're praising this is because we don't get it forever.
Yeah, it doesn't last.
And we also, it wouldn't be as precious and wonderful and extraordinary if we didn't know that it was going to come to an end.
Mm-hmm.
And not just our lives, but everything. So if we can kind of look at everything as kind of in transition all the time.
To our listeners, if you want to keep up with Wendy, she has a lot going on
these
days.
We have a lot less suffering.
You can read her column, The Barefoot Laureate, in the Grand Junction Daily Sentinel every other Sunday.
When the worst things happen to us.
And it prints in the Gunnison Times and the Norwood Post once a month.
Horrible thing happens.
There's also Word Up, which is an open mic night at Copeca Coffee in Grand Junction.
Yes, that's
hosted by Wendy and her friend John Anglum at 6 p.m. every second Tuesday of the month. It resumes after the holidays on January 9th.
Well, I like to be random and open up a book, and here's what I opened up to. It's a death poem on the surface and underneath, and it's called A Few Things We Learned from Our Friend Dale. To live in grace is to die in grace. A song is better than 1,000 books. Humility is the bottomless bowl. Where rivers meet, renew your vows. Meet everybody where they are. Generosity is the guiding star. To listen is a skill that has an eager heart and warm hands. A belly laugh is a beautiful thing. To swing on a swing is a dying man's dream. The weight that you were born to bear will glean from the soul and take to the air. There's a hidden path in the wild rye. It's not so bad having to die. The hardest part is saying goodbye. That is a few things we learned from our friend Dale, and it comes from Wise to the West, Book of Poems, that actually came out around the same time as the Poetic Imaginarium.
Thank you so much for that.
Yes.
Thank you.
To our listeners, if you want to keep up with Wendy, there's a lot of ways you can do that. You can read her column, The Barefoot Laureate, in the Grand Junction Daily Sentinel every other Sunday, and it prints in the Gunnison Times and the Norwood Post once a month. There's also Word Up, which is an open mic night at Kopeka Coffee in Grand Junction, hosted by Wendy Vitalock and John Anglum at 6 p.m. every second Tuesday of the month. It resumes after the holidays on January 9th. You can catch Wendy on KAFM 88.1 or 96.9 with her monthly show, Lit Radio. It's every third Wednesday at 12:30 p.m. For our listeners in Montrose, Wendy hosts an event called Sunday Words to the Wise. It's a monthly poetry and performance art event at Blue Corn Candle Factory Bar and Cafe. It resumes after the holidays on January 7th with guests Madison Gill and Tracy Lightsey. And you can visit Wendy's website, wendyvitalock.com. That is VIDELOCK.com, for more information about her poetry and her books. And as always, thank you for listening to the Western Colorado Writers Podcast.
The Western Colorado Writers Podcast is the official podcast of the Western Colorado Writers Forum, a nonprofit organization based in Grand Junction, Colorado. The Forum's mission is to foster a rich and diverse writing community on Colorado's western slope that invites participation from diverse cultures, customs, and life experiences. The Forum hosts Writers' Night presentations at the Grand Junction Center for the Arts on the first Tuesday of every month, where local and national writers give presentations on their craft. Sign up for the Forum's free newsletter at westerncoloradowriters.org. You can find us on Facebook by searching for Western Colorado Writers Podcast. If you have thoughts or suggestions for the podcast, please drop us a line at westerncoloradowriterspodcast@gmail.com. This podcast is sponsored in part by the Grand Junction Commission on Arts and Culture.